So let's start. Welcome to our next lecture on program optimization. So last time we considered the evaluation of polynomials. And so it's, in some sense, we learned, or the message we received was that there are several multiple ways of evaluating a polynomial. And we showed you that this Horner scheme allows to evaluate a polynomial in time, an effort requiring n multiplications and n additions if n is the degree of the polynomial. So that was nice. But now was our task to repeatedly evaluating a polynomial, namely to tabulate it for different values. Now you may say, okay, well, I have to tabulate polynomial. So there are, I guess, the first computers, which were humans sitting in huge rooms and doing calculations. They did calculations typically for these artillery tables to have better shootings, and they somehow produced long tables so that the cannoneer, I guess, only looked up the table how to, under certain parameters, how to fix the screw and then to shoot, to hit the target or something like that. So this tabulation is one of the earliest applications of general applications where a large amount of computation was required. And then there's another thing. So now you may say, so we are not interested in shooting and we don't need these tables. But at some points there are still tables around. For example, when you if you compute this sine, cosine, these kind of functions, then these are kind of complicated. How do you compute them? You have kind of a piecewise polynomial polynomial approximations, and then you evaluate these polynomials. Or for certain ranges, even in these libraries, they have the tables, and then they look it up. So there are tables. So there are certain applications when numerical computations require such tables. So at least it's some kind of problem. And here now we repeatedly evaluating a polynomial means, so if you evaluate it 100 times, then you have 100 times to provide n multiplications and additions. And then suddenly last time we realized that given that I have already a certain amount of function values, then I can determine the rest just by suitably many additions. So no multiplications at all. How come? So then that was the observation that if I have a polynomial of degree n, then the nth difference is constant. And that is, as soon as I have provided n plus 1 values, then I can take the differences, and then the successive differences until I am in the constant, and then the next value can then be determined by n additions only, namely n additions by adding up all the differences. And now what does this mean, this is an instance of this reduction in strength thing. We do a little bit of pre-computation and maintain a little bit of more informative structure, namely not just the function values, but also the differences. And then the next operation can be replaced by a cheaper operation. The operation of evaluating the polynomial can be replaced by a cheaper operation, namely by adding up the differences. So that's the point. And that's kind of an instance of reduction of strengths. So there's another instance, so this is an algorithmic principle, or kind of a philosophical principle, how one might improve algorithms. Does any other instance of that come to your mind? Think of heap sort. Heap sort is nothing else but insertion sort. You successively heap sort, no insertion sort, no, not insertion sort. You once provide a data structure, and then you know this. It's an instance of sorting by repeatedly extracting the minimum. And so clearly, if you have an unsorted list and want to determine the minimum, then that costs you linear time. So you have to go through the list and find the minimum, remove it, and then put it into the output. Now, what is the idea of heap sort? You do a little bit of more pre-computation, namely by building up a heap, and then this extraction of minimum, instead of traversing the data structure, you just have a simpler operation due to the heap data structure to get the minimum. Namely, it's a log n time operation. You quickly find the minimum, and then you have log n extra effort to kind of update the data structure so that you maintain something similar. So that is kind of, you invest a little bit to get to make your data structure or your representation of data a little bit smarter, and then expensive operations, like finding the minimum, become cheap operations, namely log n operations. Yeah? And that is the same here. Recomputing the polynomial is replaced by something similar, namely just adding up the differences. Okay, so that's kind of the message. Now, how can we kind of... So these are particular instances, and if you think a little bit about it, you might come up with more instances of that type. But so here let us just briefly see how much cost we save. So in the beginning, we have to start out with n multi for this polynomial thing with n evaluations of the function. Then we have to perform to fill in this upper triangular, the left upper triangular of this matrix. And that is kind of, this gives us quadratically many subtractions. Then we have, and then every further element, no matter how many there will be, can be then obtained using n additions only. Yeah, and that means the number of multiplications in this sense is now a constant. It depends only on the polynomial, not on the number of values, how often we want to repeat the polynomial. Now, polynomials, so typically, if you have not a numerical program, then in ordinary programs, most of the polynomials are linear. And that is in fact the case in which one which occurs in quite often in programs, and where one might hope to improve the performance of the program. And so if you have a linear function, then the first differences are already constant. So that is, and that is just if the x is incremented by h, typically the x is incremented, so think of a loop, x is incremented in a loop, then typically the loop increment is even just one, and then the difference between two successive values of the function is just this a1. And otherwise it is the a1 times the increment. And so now instead of determining repeatedly the function f of x0 plus I times h, so we just compute the first one, the first function, and then we don't do the multiplication, but just add the increment. Yeah? So that is, the multiplication is gone. So we have saved one operation. In the old days, this was an even more, crucial optimization, as multiplication was not natively supported by the CPU, so you had to construct it by two half multiplications, something like that, or by a little algorithm doing this multiplication according to the school method, which were really expensive operations, and that was saved by just replacing it by repeatedly doing addition. Now in the with more modern architectures, it's still a little bit of saving, namely saving of one operation. Okay? So it's, in that sense, one might think that... yes. Now the question is, where does it occur? And it occurs quite frequently if you have a loop counter. Here's an example, a loop counter which is incremented one by one, and for each loop iteration you have to access an array, and then you access the array in successive order, but since the elements in the array do not have size 1 but typically have some larger size, if you have a byte address machine, so it's typically 4 or 8 if it's just integers, and if it's an array of structs or something, then the increment is even larger. So that is, you have to multiply the index with some b, and that you have to add. So that is, for every, in every loop iteration, you have to do this little arithmetic calculation, and you, and now our observation is that instead of determining that, one might hope to to replace it by to squeeze out the multiplication and directly have an arrive at that program. Let us now see how in which order we kind of arrive there. So we start out with that. Here we have the address calculation. Here we have the access to the array, and here we have the increment of the loop counter. Yeah, and now I have here assumed that it is incremented by h, but you might think of, in some cases it's just incremented by 1, but this h is to have a little bit of extra generality, because sometimes it's also not incremented but decremented, then h is negative. Now the first thing what we do is to do loop rotation. Why? Because there might occur certain loop invariant computations which we might want to move out of the loop, and that in this case we would like to put it perhaps at that place, as we have seen in the last lecture, that this would be the right place to put the loop invariant code. Okay, so that's the first thing. So far no optimization, no real optimization has taken place. Now comes this reduction of strength thing. So the first thing is, we have to compute the delta. This is extra work. And we have to compute the initial address. This is this initial A. And this is loop invariant code. These kind of computations we only would like to do right in the beginning, and therefore, but we would not like to do it if the loop is never executed. So therefore, it is crucial that we have done this transformation of a while loop into a do while loop, because otherwise there would be no place where to put the green code. Okay, so that's the first thing. Then here you see in the next step, here we add also additionally, now that is what we do, this address calculation is now changed from A0 plus some some multiple of I, we now just replace that kind of calculation with A plus delta. So you see here, there was this was the original calculation, and that is now replaced with A plus delta. Okay? And still there is some room for improvement. So that is kind of the ideal type of optimization which we aim at. Now the question is, can we do it always? What are the assumptions under which we can do that kind of optimization? And that is now comes, this makes this transformation a little bit a nuisance, at least to my taste, because there are so many side conditions which you have to check. And therefore, if you ask me if I had to write a compiler and together with this optimization phases, then I would implement all kinds of things, but this reduction of strength thing only in the very at the very end. And perhaps not in that, not alone, but for some other purpose, which I will kind of have the opportunity to speak about later, namely when we do software pipelining. So then there is another instance where we might want to do things like that. Now, for the moment, now what is once again we want to do this kind of transformation. Now, what are the assumptions? So clearly, the assumption is that there is really this, that this delta here is not, does not change. So that A is really incremented in this delta fashion. In this, by this A is changed in that way. And that for, how can we kind of, what do we have to make sure? So we have to make sure really that this B and the H, that these are constants. Yeah, that they do not change during iteration. And we also have to make sure that there is no other no other change to I besides at that particular place, and that there is no assignment to A besides that one single recomputation of A. So these kind of things we have to check, and that is quite a bit. Yeah. So here that is these things. These must be must not change their values. These must be modified at exactly a single position in the loop, which is always executed. So if you do that in the branching, and that in some cases you update the I, and in some situations you don't, then it's bad, because then this calculation would kind of would not work. Or you have to make clear, okay, it might be that I is modified only in one place, in some place, but not always, but then in this particular, on the same control flow, under the same circumstances, also the A changes. So these are subtle situations which only occur if the code has been generated by one very specific forms of for loops somehow. Okay, so these are kind of things which we red. I wanted red. Which we must be very careful about, and which we have to check in detail to guarantee that the optimization is correct. The other point which we on the other hand may wonder is whether I is useful, whether I can be removed altogether. You see here I is only used for the only be used for the indexing of the array, and now this array indexing here is kind of computed independently of the I. So the I now is only used here in the guard. If we succeed to to eliminate the I also in the guard, then the I will be completely dead. And so then that removal of that code would kind of remove the eye altogether. At least this update of the eye in the loop, and that would really speed up then the loop. That would kind of we change from the index I to the increment to the address A, and that is now what is that? That is kind of what a C programmer would try to do manually. A C programmer would not kind of have this iteration I iteration variable to iterate over the array, but would place a pointer to the first address and then increment the pointer, and then the pointer would be updated in the same way as we have here, more or less automatically inferred. So now here's the assumptions on what how we can eliminate the variable I. So I may not be used elsewhere because then it would not be could not be eliminated, and the the initialization of A is transformed, yes, into that's what we did, but then the other thing is the loop condition must also be transformed, and that is we have to recover somehow the I from the A, and the I is somehow obtained from the A by subtracting subtracting a zero and then dividing by b, or put it differently, instead we transfer the condition I is less than n is transformed by, in the following way, we multiply both sides with b, and then add both a zero to both sides, and then we this if we do that, then we arrive at an equivalent condition for the I. Yeah. So the ultimate condition then is we check whether I is less than n0 plus b times n. Then we do not have to use this division thing, but expressed the condition on the I by a condition on the A. But clearly that only works under yet another side condition. We must check that this multiple B must be different from zero, because otherwise we would kind of always check that then B zero times N would be always be 0 times n would be 0, that is the n does not change, but and the a does also not change, and in that sense the delta would be 0, and that means we increment always 0 to the a and check for something, and that means we have a non-terminating loop. While the original loop would terminate, we would always access the same entry in the array, yes, but at least the iteration would terminate. So now one might wonder whether such kind of program is what the programmer expected, but you never know what the programmer wanted to do, and you cannot kind of, only because the compiler thinks it is a stupid program, introduce non-termination, where originally, without optimization, the program would be perfectly fine. Yeah. So that is, the compiler is not to judge the quality. The purpose of the compiler is not to judge the quality of the programmer's code. Okay, so that means we kind of have now a pattern, if you like, a pattern which we would like to identify in the code and then optimize for that. And now perhaps you should, when I say call it like that, understand or get an idea or a feeling why I explain that kind of very specific transformation here, because this is a pattern. So people come up with all kinds of patterns. So they see a certain piece of code. They understand for this particular piece of code can be optimized in that and that way and replaced by something better. Now, in order to make that an optimizing program transformation, you have to define what is this pattern in the code, what is kind of the characteristics of it, try to formulate it as robustly and as liberal as possible, and then try to detect that kind of pattern and try to then replace it by some better code. And that is that kind of principle, this form of tailored optimizations, of that you can come up with many. Because there's always, in numerical code, for example, you always see, look at it, I could write, improve on that, and then tailor an optimization precisely for that. And in the old days, when the Fortran compilers still outperformed the C compilers, then that was precisely because of that, that there are, in these numerical codes, there are always very many repeated kind of patterns, and they had a huge amount of rules how to improve precisely these patterns to get something better. So now let's see for this particular pattern where we try to kind of exemplify this this kind of procedure. What is the prerequisites which we have to do? Well, we have to identify the loops. We have to identify these iteration variables, and in that case, it is both the I and the A. We have to determine whether something does not change its value throughout the loop, and we have to, we have to kind of find how these variables are used. So now, once again, for the loops, we had already just for loop rotation, or we rotated the loops, and that kind of meant that also we identified loops, and only those loops which we can rotate, or which are already rotated, because they are do-while loops, these are the ones where we kind of can hope to do further improvements on. And so these loops have been identified by back edges. And now if I have such a back edge, then the loop with head V is those program points in which those program points in the control flow graph, which in the control flow graph, that one is the control flow graph of all containing all program points which are dominated by the loop head. So these are not only the nodes in the body, but also everything which follows the loop. And that is, in that sense, which might be behind the loop. And then from that GV, we obtain the loop by taking all those edges which are dominated by V, from which you can again reach the V. So that means that is kind of, you can come back to the V. Okay. So here in this example, this is the dominator tree. Now the G for G1 is all these nodes, and you can come back to 1 only from these nodes. So therefore, this is then the loop identified by the loop head 1. Okay? And so that now we have the loops. And then we might be interested in edges which during each iteration are executed exactly once, because these are where we expect the updates. So that is, here we have such a back edge. we take such a loop, we remove the back edges. Here we remove the back edge, and then we get hopefully an acyclic graph, and then we may look at that where it kind of is decomposed. So here we have, so this is something like, if we remove this particular edge, then it kind of splits into two. That is again one of these graph properties, that it's no longer connected if we remove these edges. Whether it splits or not, that one can also, so here is kind of an expressing the same property by means of the predominator relation, but so it's a graph property which we may check. Clearly on the level, on the source, level of source code, these instructions, which definitely will be evaluated during each iteration of the loop, these are more easily obtained. Namely, you simply look at the sequence of statements, and it must be one of those statements. The only thing is there should not be a break or a continue before. No, a break. I guess a break is no problem, but a continue before or any other kind of jumps, that would be a disaster. But if it's no such jump out of the loop, then you find these edges where these statements, which are executed exactly once in every iteration of the loop, you find them among these SIs. It's amazing that there are so this G in the end somehow is weird. Okay, now we may look at the search for variables, which are of this iteration variables. So these are variables I, which are updated only at edges, which separates the loop into the loop body into two, and the update should be for our optimization here, it should always be of this particular form for some loop constant h. And the loop what is a loop constant h? So there, one again has many choices how to define that. The simplest thing is we only accept constants here, so 1 or 2 or 25 and nothing else. And that would do for most of the cases. It could be that this is a, now you could also do something more liberal by letting H any expression which only depends on variables for which the loop does not contain any definition. That would be an alternative way, but that is requires more checking of conditions, and typically will not extend the applicability of the transformation a great deal, because typically, if it's a constant, then people write down the constant. It's not so frequent that people write down a very complicated expression there for the iteration variable I. So one could therefore simply look for plain constants here for the H. Okay. So by that we can check all the conditions preconditions which we have to guarantee for our pattern of reduction of strengths to be applicable, optimization pattern to be applicable. So that we could do. And then we may, by that we can, again, now one to speak, to say something, some very last comment on this transformation. It is not so impressive anymore as multiplication has become cheaper, but still it reduces the cost of a loop. And everything by which you improve a loop is great, because when you improve straight line code, this doesn't give you any benefit. You have to concentrate on the loops, and if you can simplify expressions there, then this pays off. So therefore, it is still advisable. Okay. So now let me kind of tell you that there are other examples where this reduction of strengths is applicable, and actually where we ourselves have applied it to, and that is the thing with semi-naive iteration. I don't know whether it's in some sense the same idea. And this semi-naive iteration has been popular in the database community when evaluating recursive queries. Have you attended some course on implementation of databases? I think Thomas Neumann is the hero in that area. And so, but I guess you all have attended some kind of database course. Was there something about recursive queries, recursively defined predicates? So there you have to do kind of fixed point computation. So, and that is kind of similar to the fixed point computation which we do here. And the thing what you compute there is you have a predicate on sets. A predicate is a set of tuples. So if it's recursively defined, so then you have to kind of to solve a fixed point equation over sets. So here is such a fixed point computation over sets. You start out with the empty set, and then you have you apply f to x. So this is your t. You check whether the larger set is already included. Everything is included in X already. Then we are done. But if it's not yet included, then we add the T to the X, and then the new T is then the f of X. Yeah, probably. I wonder why did I? I could have put the. So that is. So now you may wonder. Why did I write it down so weirdly? Because here is the same as there, but the initialization of the T also uses. I didn't initialize it with X itself. That I could also do, but. But the empty set is always included in the empty set, and then the test would not be, so I would not have any that it would not work. So therefore, f of the empty set, f squared of the empty set, and so on. And these sets which I compute in that way, I always have to check whether they are when the iteration stabilizes by this particular test. Okay, now that's something which does not really surprise us. It's kind of solving a single equation. It's kind of solving a single equation of the form x equals f of x over sets. Yeah, we could also call it a constraint, so then it would be like that. Yeah, that's, we want to determine the least solution of that. And, that is kind of a very specific case of all what our algorithms are trivial for one variable equations, then we simply iterate, and there's nothing else what we can do. But it determines, turns out that that is, in some sense, not a very, well, it, one finds out, one gets the impression that this, that we waste a lot of computing energy here. Why? If F is returns a set and it's monotonic, then it returns a larger and larger set of elements, but it returns always the same elements which we have seen already and some more. Now it's stupid if it's if the set grows slowly and is grows large, then we always return these very large sets which we have already seen and we are bored about, and then come two new extra things. And then we take them, add them, and then we again apply the F and get something still a little bit more larger, then two more elements arrive and we have still thousands others which we have seen. And that's a little bit of a nuisance, and we might wonder, couldn't we simply do the following? If the set increases a little bit, say by two elements, then in the next round we only look at these two new elements and see what F does with these, and so on. And then the intermediate effort is kind of much smaller, and we only have, in the end, we also have accumulated the full set. And that is the idea of semi-naive iteration. It actually, it works well, or actually it works only if this function is distributive. And that means recall what that means. F is distributive, that means if I apply, let me kind of first remove all that things which are written there. F, so F, if I have the old X and I have added some kind of delta, and distributivity means that F commutes with the union in this case, and that means it's the same as if I would take F of X, which was the last value which I had, and then extend it with F of delta. And so it's really, in order to get the next iteration, I only have to need to propagate the increment of the last iteration, which is the delta. And then I do just apply F to that, and so on, and so on. And so I always have to apply F to very few elements, namely two or three what arrived in the last iteration. And that makes life much more easy. So here down there now is the new iteration which I have, which I then propose. So I again would start with the empty set. So X accumulates the values. And then I now, if I apply F to X, since it's X is initially the empty set, though if I apply F to X, everything is new. So therefore this is the delta. And if the delta is different from the empty set, if something new arrived, if it's different from the empty set, then I have to add it to the X, so X gets larger, and also then I have to kind of apply. Then what is the new delta? The new delta is obtained by applying F to delta and subtracting everything which I have already seen. Yeah, and F applying to delta, this is this one, and then removal, everything what I have seen, this is already seen, is this one, and this gives me the new delta. And when the new delta is empty, then that means that everything which comes, I have already seen, and then I'm done. Yeah? You see the how it works? And this kind of iteration is called as I already have said now multiple times, this is called semi-naive iteration. It is semi-naive because it's so naive iteration I would take the full set, and semi-naive is I take only the increments. I think there are some people who also have kind of invented quarter semi-naive or something, which kind of made even more of that little kind of improvements, but I don't think that anything more then this one pays off. And that means in the first iteration, so now what So to visualize the effect, that is kind of the sequence how the approximation to the fixed point is produced, the x, the sequence of the axis, instead of that, so we compute the axis, but we have only by accumulating it, what we really compute is the deltas. And the next delta is whatever has been added in the last iteration. And then, that's it. And now assuming that the cost of applying this F to a set is proportional to the number of elements in the set. So assuming that, I don't know whether that's always a meaningful assumption, but at least it's a reasonable assumption. And then in the naive iteration, what can happen is that in every iteration, the set increases, say, at least by one. And then the iteration terminates at the nth iteration, then that means you have to add all the values from one to n, and then one more iterate, you have to apply it to the full set, finally, to establish that a fixed point has been found, and that gives a quadratic number of cost, a quadratic cost. Now, in the semi-naive way, the cost is much cheaper because you apply F only to the elements which are new, and if all of them add up, if all of that adds up to n, then in the worst case you have n evaluations and overall cost. Contribution of one from each of the evaluations, and the rest, this part here, so to speak, sums up to n. So you get a linear cost. So by that, this kind of will not save the world, but it at least saves you a factor of n, if n is the size of the result. So that means if the result is small, then you save virtually nothing, and if the result is a huge set, then the saving could also be huge. One must, to be fair, now you may ask me, is this state of the art in when they compute in databases? Well, in databases, recursive queries are still, and recursively defined predicates still are not very popular. So therefore they do not invest so much in the optimization of such kind of predicates. That is the one thing. And the other thing is that these databases are very well optimized for dealing with data, with lumps of data, which are kind of stored consecutively somewhere in memory. And they do block moves and all kind of low-level details. I don't know what. I'm not so much an expert in database implementations, but that means, and this dealing with all these, if you have many updates, all many little updates, then this the advantage of that is not so great over having these perhaps moving huge amounts of data around, but doing it in a very fast fashion. So in that sense, this effect is a little bit blurred in practice. So, and you might look into your favorite database and check whether it supports recursive queries and whether it does semi-naive iteration, and perhaps you will find there is no semi-naive iteration in it. Okay, but still it's an interesting idea, and I must say we have kind of we have provided a implementation. We are not interested in databases, but we are interested in data log, which is a kind of prologue dialect, where one can nicely express also program analysis in, and we have provided a fast implementation using fancy fixed point algorithms and semi-naive iteration to get decent implementations of that. And it works, I would say, it works very well due to such kind of effects. Okay, is there any question to this reduction of strength optimization? If not, then let us kind of proceed. The next kind of idea is what people now, we get peephole optimization. This is in some sense a very trivial idea, but still a useful one. So it's not always the fancy stuff which gives the most benefit, but sometimes the most trivial kind of optimization. So what is there, the idea? Well, the problem is, the idea is again, we want to replace expensive code by better code. And we would, on the big scale, we would replace the inefficient program by an efficient one. So that's our ultimate goal. And in general, we do not succeed. But why? Because the program is large. And there are many possibilities how the search space for better programs is extremely large. But if the program is extremely small, then why not? Then we can, in principle, replace this program by the optimal program if the program only consists of two lines or is a basic block. Then we have a good chance to optimize it very radically. And that is somehow the idea of this peephole optimization. That is, we locally try to do the best what we can. That is, and therefore we kind of take a small window which we place somewhere onto the code. This is this peephole where we look through and see something, only very little, and then we try to optimize aggressively inside exactly that window and only there. And there we can do everything what we like. And in some sense, one more side remark, if you think of, we have not talked about JIT compilation, so just-in-time compilation. In some sense, this is the optimization taking place there is an instance of that, because you see a certain small piece of code which is repeatedly executed, so you want to optimize it. But it's a small piece of code, and you ignore the rest, and you try to improve that piece of code as much as you can. And there, I must say, okay, so there you can do even more aggressive things than here. You can do even optimistic optimizations. What are optimistic optimizations? The surroundings is unknown. You don't know what it does. You have observed that it is. So X has always had the value 5. You don't know whether it really always will in the future also have always the value 5. But for the moment, you observed only the value 5. So you assume the value 5. And then you optimize for that value. And then you find later, oh, my assumption was wrong. And then you have a fallback position. So in that sense, you can do, using these kind of optimistic ideas, optimizations at runtime can be still more aggressive than those offline optimizations, which take care of all situations of the surroundings. But still, it is, in some sense, you look at a restricted portion, and that's the same idea. And then you try to do the same, whatever you can there. So, now, and there, in this kind of peephole optimization allows us to do things which are otherwise also not easy to do. For example, this kind of optimization, you kind of have this read from memory and then also a post increment of X. Now clearly this is in our intermediate language, this is the only thing which we can write down, but if you think of the hardware instructions, there might be hardware instructions which access from memory and then do kind of a post-processing, have two effects, so to speak. One instruction having two effects. These you can introduce into your code by such kind of peephole optimization. Yeah. And then you could, what else could you do? So for example, in this case, you have this minus A plus A that you could kind of, this is algebraic simplifications, which you could do. Okay, x equals x, that you could kind of optimize away completely. X equals zero. Now then there are kind of architectures where loading constants is always expensive. But you could have replace it by that one. Now this is the instruction on the right. I always find it intriguing and kind of a little bit counterintuitive that one does it because x has no value. It may not be initialized even. And still you may use that to produce a zero. And that is what people do in x86 code. I have seen such kind of things. And that is because in hardware there is no memory cell has no value. So it's always something in it. And if you use the XOR from your arithmetical unit, you can produce zero like nothing. Yeah, that's a strange thing. And then there's this other thing. Sometimes this multiplication with two, if you have to kind of create a constant in an argument or that might be again another instruction which you would like if you do not have it directly because such constant arguments in your instruction set, or it might be too complicated, or you might have to use a weird shift operation which you don't like, so then you can still do it just you go to addition. So in some sense that is also kind of a reduction of strength. You replace multiplication with this particular constant by an addition. Okay, so now there are many more examples of these peephole optimizations. Most of them are very specific to your instruction set and such kind of phenomena. And therefore, I'm not aware that there is a very refined theory or conceptual something in this peephole thing. You do whatever you can. And therefore, you see, I'm already done with it and I can only give you the idea of it, but I cannot provide you with any background theory or concepts. What we additionally should speak about is that now we have done all this optimizations on our control flow graphs, and in many cases we have inserted new nodes and new edges. But the optimization typically, and sometimes also certain nodes became unreachable, because we removed certain edges. Think of constant propagation. So there we removed certain edges. But in most cases, the optimization took place by replacing the label of an edge with a no-op. So if we have exhaustively applied all kinds of these transformations, we have a lot of no-ops in our code. And the structure might also be a little bit different from the original structure. Now, in the end, we cannot execute a control flow graph on our hardware. What we need is kind of a sequentialization of our code, and that is we have to kind of to spill out in the end our control flow graphs as code. So now the question is it easy? Is it complicated? Well, if the structure has changed a lot, then this is not completely trivial. And now the question is, and there are different, and it's not the case that every linearization of the code is equally efficient. So there you can make mistakes there. So let's see. The first thing is we have all this no ops. How can we get rid of them? So that we can still do on the level of control flow graphs in the following way. If that is an edge, then this U1, at least in the way how we kind of defined our control flow graphs, then this V1 has no further outgoing edge. It has only this knob edge. Why? Because if it has two outgoing edges, then it was originated from a branching statement. And then we have had these guards, and the removal of a guard only occurred when we were able to skip one of them, and then so there was no branching anymore. Yeah, so that means whenever we have a no op, then we have only one successor node, and that means we could kind of instead of considering them as two nodes, we could kind of move to keep only one of them, for example, the V. Yeah. So here in that case, we could kind of, if we had this, we could kind of join somehow these two nodes. And how do we do it? So we do that by introducing a new function, or a function which I like to call next. So next of a program point is obtained in the following way. I check the outgoing edges. If there is an outgoing edge with knob, then this is the only outgoing edge. The next is the next of this successor node in this direction. Otherwise, if there is no outgoing edge labeled with knob, then so that means that either it's labeled with something else or there are more than one outgoing edges. In that case, the next of U is U. So then it's already done. Yeah. So clearly, this definition here, next of U is defined by next of V. This is a if we had a cycle in our control flow graph where all nodes are labeled with knob, then we had then this would not terminate. But on the other hand, if we had such a cycle, then this means somehow that this cycle must originate from a cycle in the original control flow graph. And if in the original control flow graph we had such a cycle, then we usually have a condition, a guard somewhere in that cycle. And the only thing when this guard is maybe absent is when we have a definitely non-terminating program, and then that means we have a definitely non-terminating program where we were able to remove all the labels inside this non-terminating program, and that is a particularly weird non-terminating program, and we may check for that in advance and kind of warn the user about it. And otherwise, in the usual programs, this will never occur. And then, if it doesn't occur, then we kind of can replace every edge from U with a label to V, and now this label is different from knob, and we do that by letting it point to the next of V. So by that we kind of skip all the the knob operations and go to the first node after the sequence of knob operations. And if we do that, then all knob edges, after that we can remove all the knob edges, and that means, and then we have kind of a program without knob edges anymore. So in this particular program here, so I kind of said that one next of one, so one has two outgoing edges, so one next of one is one, next of three is four, because we have a knob edge here, and next of five is six, then we have the knob edge there, and then we can kind of then we have these kind of new edges, and then those nodes with outgoing edges knob can be removed, like this one and that one, and we must a little bit be careful with the start node. So if this were a knob, then we have to make this one the start node, and then we can also remove this one. Yeah? If next of zero is one. Okay. So that is removed. So that was not so difficult to get rid of the knob nodes. Now, a more significant problem is the question of linearization. So we now have to put it into to produce a linear arrangement of instructions. Or into a linearly arranged sequence of instructions. And then the first point is, which we might observe, is that not every linearization is equally efficient. So let us see this now. Look at that particular example. So this is a loop, and this is a rotated loop. So what kind of things could we have? So this means here I have a linearization of the code. And if E1 is satisfied, then we go to 3. And that is the body. This here should be the body. This is the body. Then we go to if it's satisfied, we jump to 2, and if then if E2 is satisfied, we jump to 4, and otherwise we go to 1. So now what is bad? So this means in every iteration starting from I go to 1, so that is a little bit of a stupid... If the code is like that, then it is like that. It's not a perfectly rotated loop. If it were a perfectly rotated loop, then this E1 would be the same as E2, and we would have a jump here. So that would be a different story. But here now, in this particular case... it's still a while loop, but this while loop has kind of a break statement. So we could think of it as such, and we should also think of it as if I kind of, it's a very simplified program. So here is some code, but we might also think of that here is some code. So this is really a minimalistic control flow graph which might occur. Okay, so what happens? So the problem is what you do after this condition. When this condition is satisfied, then you will execute the loop. Now, if this condition were not satisfied, then you leave the loop. And leaving the loop is something which you could expect to happen rarely. But staying in the loop is something which should happen more often. So clearly, at the end of the loop, you have to jump to the beginning of the loop. So this kind of back jump is inevitable. Because, so if you have, think of that the body is a block of code, and then you have to go to the beginning because you want to re-execute it. So that is, this back jump is somehow inevitable. But the first jump is evitable, can be avoided. And that is kind of, here, this kind of condition, this kind of, you jump to the beginning of the body. That's something which is stupid. So it's much better, therefore, to jump when you leave the loop and just continue when you are inside the loop, because then you do not jump. Why is not jumping cheaper than jumping?
Because it's a conditional branch, and then you have to do branch prediction.
Yes, because typically it's not so that the hardware behaves as follows. It takes the instruction, executes it, and when it's done, it fetches the next one, and so on, so one step after the other. That is kind of an idealized model. The reality is, the hardware makes the assumption, in some sense, that the instructions come one after the other. And that is the thing where it is optimized for. So it kind of, it's like a block, in some sense it's like a block move. It kind of moves all of them in a go, and only if it later discovers, oh, I was wrong here, this instruction is long, it has been wrongly fetched, then it has kind of a possibility of changing its decision. But so, and the reason is that the different instructions are not executed one after the other, but after in a certain pipeline fashion. And so you don't know if you jumped when you have fetched one instruction, you do not yet know whether it's a jump or not, or where it will jump to, and you still have already fetched the next instruction. And hopefully you are lucky and nothing goes wrong with it. So therefore, if you here in that case, this strategy to just take the next instruction would be very good in most cases of the iteration, and would be bad only in one situation, namely when you leave the loop. And so therefore this is a much better thing, and therefore I wrote here cache behavior, because there is something like an instruction cache, and there's an instruction cache, and you, yeah, where you kind of put the next instructions to be fetched into. Okay, so now how can we kind of arrange the code in such a way that those that you never that you tr- that we try not to jump at the beginning of the loop, but only jump when we leave the loop. So for that we kind of have now we could have nested loops. So therefore we would kind of one idea would be to assign temperatures to nodes. So if a node is has high temperature, then this should be no jump. So you do not jump. You only jump to nodes which are colder. Yeah. So and this means that the temperature somehow should kind of correspond to the nesting depth. So this idea that you kind of try to optimize to have these kind of temperature things, that is something which also people apply when they deal with their cache or their memory optimization. Then they try to keep, so the temperature then is the usage, the expectation of usage of data, and data which are expected to be used more often, you keep it in a fast memory, and things which are less frequently used, then they are colder, and that means you can put them far away. And something which you never need at all, you can put into the garbage. So in some sense, that is there you also, if you have such expectations or estimations of usage, then you can assign temperatures and then use this temperature for optimization. So here in the example, then we would find that we have the predominator tree, we have this back edge to one, and that kind of allows us to identify that as a loop. So accordingly, this here is a loop, and therefore jumping into the loop means jumping to something, going to something hotter. So that means here this loop gets, so if the if we measure the temperature with the nesting depth inside loops, then we would have zero for zero on program point 4 and one for program points 1, 2, and 3. And accordingly, since when I have the choice at program point 1 to jump either to program point 4 or program point 2, then I decide according to the temperature, and so I would jump to 4 and not to 2. Now, if I have a more complicated example like that, then how would then the temperatures look like? So then here is are the back edges, and here are the corresponding loops, and that gives us the temperature. So the inner loop then would have temperature 2, the outer loop would have temperature 1, and outside of that loop we would have temperature 0. And that kind of allows us here, for example, at program point 3 to find out, okay, in both directions I stay inside the loop, but I would prefer the program point 4 not to jump to, because program point 4 is inside the most inner loop. Yeah. And clearly that only works if the loops are properly nested. Now if I... But the definition works also for all kinds of loops, not just while loops. So here is a more complicated situation. What do we have here? I guess this one here is a while loop. And then here we have a... this is inside an if-then-else and inside a do-while loop. And then one might have a dominator tree as follows. The 0 dominates everything. The 1 dominates broken points 2, 3, and also 4 and 5. But 2 and 3 do not dominate single nodes. But still, there is such a thing. There are back edges from 2 to 1. This gives this loop, and there is a back edge from 4 to 0, and that gives us the outer loop, and that outer loop also contains the broken points 2 and 3, because they are dominated by 1. No, they are dominated by... yes, they are dominated by 1. Why is does not... I wonder now, why is it, according to our definition, why should 5 not be... Yeah, because from 5 I cannot reach... From 5 I cannot reach again... program point 0, and therefore 5 is not inside the body, is not considered as inside the body of the loop whose loop head is 0. Okay, so that is out of the game, and then so therefore now here you see the temperatures, and that means at program point if we decide at program point 4, so at program point 4 we have to jump to program point 0, I guess, but at So where would be an interesting choice? So for example, at broken point 3, we might wonder whether we should jump to 5 or jump to 4, and then we see at broken point 3, we should definitely jump to 5 and continue with broken point 4. Okay, so now here is the general approach. So for every node, we determine the temperature, and then we perform a pre-order DFS over the control flow graph. And if an edge leads to a node we have already generated code for, okay, so then there is no possibility. So if we have already output a node, then we would have to continue there, then we have to jump. So that's kind of a back jump, which we cannot avoid. If a node has two successors, so that's the interesting situation. Now, what is it? What happens here? Yeah, if a node has two successors with different temperature, then it's clear that we jump to the colder of the two nodes. And if both successors are equally warm, then okay. Then we don't know, and then we can choose either the one or the other. Okay. So that kind of finishes this kind of a little bit of load. So we have, you see, we have already entered quite close to the we have approached quite closely the hardware level of our code, but we may still go one step back and think about our intermediate language. Our intermediate language so far was we had no procedures. And the question is, what can we do with procedures? Are we doomed when there are procedures, or can we do some kind of optimization also with respect to procedures? And I would say, if you want to have more aggressive optimizations, then you have to optimize procedures, because on the one hand they are very convenient. Every decent programmer will make extensive use of defining all kinds of auxiliary procedures, use it kind of as a method of structuring his or her ideas and modularizing your code and reusing pieces of code. So therefore, these procedures are extremely important in all their disguises. So sometimes they are functions, sometimes they are methods. So, but all of them essentially on the intermediate level, if you like, boil down to some kind of procedures. And here, now procedures, if we consider procedures, then immediately we are faced with a huge variety of programming language design decisions, because procedures typically have parameters, and they compute something, and they might want to return results. And then the question is, how may a procedure return a result, and how do we pass values into a procedure? So there is in the last years, or even in the last decades, now this call by value parameter passing has become kind of the standard way how to do things. So C has provides passing by things by value. Java has taken up this idea, and I think C# is also not so much different. But then there are other ways also. Think of C++ and good old Pascal and Modular. They have also this passing by reference. And then the question is, so what is passing by reference? In some sense, you could consider it as C programmers would say, passing by reference is nothing else as passing a pointer to something. and it's only a syntactical kind of something to translate one into the other. That is could be one idea. Yeah, so we might take this point of view. We might have another opinion. But so in that sense, calling by reference can be somehow handled if we pass addresses. That would be one thing. And then there is this thing, how to pass results. So there was in the old days of Algol, they had result parameters. So you could kind of pass parameters whose values are set by the procedure. So that was the returning of the results. And you could, but if it's a function, it will simply return a value. And the C, what is the C style of returning results? You could think of C as a functional language, so it will return its results as by the functions, as a functional value. But that's, I guess, that is not the way how people, a C programmer would think of it. A C programmer would say the return value of a function only indicates whether the function succeeded or whether some failure occurred and returns only the error value. And so you have to check the function result to know whether it succeeded, and the real result is returned as a parameter. So you pass a pointer and that pointer will receive the result. So that's, and actually the same is for object-oriented programming, I guess. I would have thought a method may return its result. That's perhaps my naive way, because I like functional programming, but I guess the Java enthusiast and object-oriented programming guru would always say a method returns its result by modifying the attributes of the object for which it is called, by modifying the object. And the return value, again, is only some kind of status information, if at all. But from this little discussion, you see that there are multiple ways how to communicate with a procedure. On the hardware level, it's much simpler in some sense. On the hardware level, there's only one concept, namely the concept of global and local variables. And inside the procedure, you have local variables, and you communicate with the outside world via global variables. So you could think of now, how does that be? So in some sense, you could think of that sometimes your registers are distinguished within these in global and local registers, and they are kind of distinguished in whether they are caller safe or callee safe or so. So global variables may be modified by the outside world, and then the called procedure may access the globals, copies the values into their local registers, use the local registers to do their local computations, and then kind of export the results by modifying again global registers. And then the caller kind of may access the globals after the call and get by that the result, may import the results of the call procedure. So communication goes through global variables or registers or global memory, and the local intermediate computation within a procedure is by means of dedicated registers which are kind of removed or overwritten after the call, and they do not survive the call. So that now you have the caller who has local registers and the callee who has also local registers, but you have only a monolithic set of registers. So what does hardware do? It saves the local registers to the stack. Then they are free for the call procedure to modify, and then afterwards they are the local registers of the caller are restored after the call. So in this way, it looks The programming perspective to these registers is that local registers simply survive the call, while globals may change. Global registers may change. Okay? So this point of view indicates that from a low-level point of view, we do not provide, so we can take the relaxed point of view by simplifying the formalism by using procedure without parameters at all. And the only thing what we additionally introduce is that we have now two kinds of variables, those which are local and those which are global. And the locals are only visible inside a particular call, and they are gone after the call, and the globals survive. So that would be the idea. And then also we need one more thing. Program execution must start somehow, and then there is one dedicated procedure which we call main. So that's kind of the C tradition. In Pascal, there was a block of code which was executed at program start, but that can be could also be considered as a dedicated procedure called main. So that's for it for today, and we meet again next week, and have a nice day. Thank you.